Hello and welcome back to The Great Game, an Australian mega game podcast. I'm Patrick, and in this episode I sat down with Jack for a little in-house discussion of God Emperor. God Emperor is Jack's, I think, first fully designed mega game. It's been around the world. It's running in Sydney very soon in May. In fact, our tickets for the game will be going on sale, you know, just a couple of days after this episode comes out. So keep an eye on sydneymegagamers.com if you're keen to come along. We've talked a lot about God Emperor in the past on this show, but we've never really got into the nitty-gritty and dug into the design process Jack went through. So this was a really long-time-coming conversation. Really enjoyed it, and I hope you do too. So quick reminder, you can find us online. We are on Facebook and also on Discord. There'll be links in the show notes to both of those. We're pretty keen to hear from you, the listeners, about anything you'd like to hear in future episodes. Anyone you would like to hear from, people who we can interview or speak to about different games and designs. And always just happy to hear what you think about the show. Final disclaimer, this episode, unfortunately, we did have a couple of little audio issues, so hopefully it's not too distracting. Done the best we can to clean it up. All that said, I hope you enjoy. All right, so Jack, after what? 18 episodes. I think this is episode 18. obligatorily mentioning God Emperor just about every episode. We finally get to chat about it.
Product placement in sponsorship deal from the co-host. Yeah.
So we're finally talking about God Emperor. So I won't spoil anything. You can talk about what God Emperor is, but I will just plug right off the bat. You've already talked about God Emperor once with the Mega Game Assembly. So we'll have a link below for that interview if people want to go and hear a bit about the game. And hopefully today we'll be covering some new stuff. But I guess up front, before we get into it, what, you know, who are you and where did you come from? How did you get into mega game stuff? What led to God Emperor?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Jack. lovely to meet you all. But I initially got into God Emperor. Well, I mean, so I got into mega games the way most people do. I won't go through it, but Watch the Skies was my introduction, and running that a few times was the way that I got into running mega games and really fell in love with it. The origin for God Emperor was actually a friend of mine, Melissa Hearn, who was interested in, after we ran the first couple of Watch the Skies, proposed the idea for a Game of Thrones mega game, which is obviously a very perfect fit for the mega game format, and one that I think, you know, a few people have done now. Obviously, Becky has done Everyone Dies. There's Aegon's Conquest, I think it's pronounced, another mega game. But back in the day, I wasn't aware of any of those, so we were very excited about the idea. I have, at the time of designing it, I had never read the books or seen the Game of Thrones series. And I still haven't. I've read two of the books. I dropped out in book two. I watched the first episode of the TV show, never committed for the long haul, and I guess nowadays I'm glad I didn't.
yeah.
Unfortunately.
You're in the era where it's popular to say that, so you're safe.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, things have really turned, which makes me happy. I decided early on, I mean, we decided, I really wanted to make sure that it felt like its own world. It wasn't just a sponsored project or that it wasn't just Game of Thrones with the labels ripped off. Like, it had the same feeling to it and those same emotions that Game of Thrones evokes of the betrayal and the, you know, the alliances between houses and the sudden deaths and all those kinds of things. But after running Watch the Skies a few times, was really keen to do my own thing a bit more, I guess. So yeah, Melissa and I chatted out a bunch. Eventually Melissa decided to drop out of the project just with, you know, life things, and I decided to carry it on. And it was originally called War of Kings, and it went on to become God Emperor.
Right. Yeah, it's funny. I'm glad that you brought that out early, because when you had a chat with the Maker Game Assembly, it was sort of halfway through where you were like, all right, I got to admit, I've never watched Game of Thrones, or I haven't done this or that. I think you might have blindsided everyone. But yeah, no, it's very distinct. But at the same time, having played it and now looking at running it soon, I can say it does have all the thematic feel to it, even though it's a bit more setting wise and story wise, it's in a different world and it's a bit more grimdark, or it's actually a bit more open to interpretation, really, when you look at how it's written.
Definitely. That's something I wanted to try. Something I was really inspired by Stalin when I was writing it. It's just what was it called? The disappearings or something like that they were called, but the way that members of parliament and things were edited out of photos and that they were completely blanked and disappeared. And that kind of idea of propaganda and control of information and things like that were really inspiring. So I think it works really well for a mega game in that I had this experience actually with entering a Game of Thrones LARP when not knowing knowing the basics, but having no serious understanding of the Game of Thrones lore or background details or information, and being completely out at sea, right? Like just having very little idea of what's going on, because I'm interacting with these people who are seriously into this incredibly detailed lore that is in these huge volumes of books and the TV series, and feeling like that was a huge barrier to trying to get into the game, right?
Yeah.
And so I felt like this idea of like, oh, the real history of this world has been wiped out by this God Emperor, or destroyed, like the old religions have been suppressed. Like that really sets up a great atmosphere where the lore can be much more up to your interpretation, and there's a very low barrier to entry to get into it. Like you understand this one kind of basic fact, which is like there's this terrible God Emperor ruling over everything and he's evil. And there's a couple of, you know, fun details in there, but you don't have to have a textbook understanding of pages and pages of background lore. And if you go in and you're really not sure how something works, then there is a natural explanation, right? Which is that this history has been suppressed.
Yes. Yeah. So it's kind of covered all bases, like depending on who's running it and how much depth they want to go into the world, go nowhere, or they can, you know, fill it out themselves. Another thing that, like, speaking of that, because I hadn't really thought about it until I started looking at running it and I was reading the rule book and I realized, oh, so the only setting information really is on the first page, and it's like half a page, and it's very epic and sort of sets the scene. It's kind of like the start of a adventure video game where it's like, you're this person and you're in this world and there's this thing happening and now you have to go and fulfill your destiny. And then the rest of the book's just got the rules written in a really clear way, and then just littered with tiny little things like you can't talk about this, or the God Emperor doesn't like this, or you got to be careful about this because it can be treacherous at the war map. But there's not like huge amounts of background and paragraphs about, you know, the history and the lore, and you got to read about the different religions and stuff. Like it's all very light, but it has theme. It gives you a feels without shoving like a narrative down your throat. So I think that's a really good, like a fine balance that you found. But one thing I was going to say that you did, so when I played this game, when was it? 2016?
Mm-hmm. Long time ago now.
Yeah, a very long time. Before the dark times. when we played it, you did this interesting thing, and I actually quite like this, how it's been canonized now. But you did this thing where we've talked on the show about casting, and where players come and they sign up and then they get cast into certain roles. And instead of doing that, you kind of did a casting thing where, well, I wouldn't call it casting, but you let the players design the world a little bit and their teams and that kind of thing. Do you want to talk us through how you came?
Yeah, Absolutely. So when we started, when we ran the game, we sent out a SurveyMonkey survey where people could effectively, you know, design their own noble house a little. We had a selection of noble house sigils that they could choose from with different, like, you know, a snake or a flame or crossed swords, you know, those kinds of symbols. They could choose their own house words of, you know, what the slogan of their house is, essentially. They got to choose a bunch of house attributes, like, ooh, are you, decrepit, or are you, you know, vengeful, you know, these kinds of things where you got to choose. And it was purely a flavor thing. And it informed how I wrote the faction briefings for each house, which again were fairly brief. Like, they give you a bit of an idea of what type of thing you do. They talk about how loyal you are to the God Emperor. There are some houses who are a bit more loyal than others or a bit more in favor of him. And so I think it was purely flavor. There's no there were no mechanics linked to any of that little mini character creation moment. But I think it was nice to have, make you feel like it's your house and you have ownership of it.
Yeah, and it did. Like, as the players, we realized, I think, during that process that it wasn't necessarily going to have a mechanical payoff, but we were really invested in it, and we got together online and we shared all these ideas, and we kind of, amongst our team of five, we voted on what flag do we want and what name do we want and this and that. And we were something like Decaying Shadow Brokers or something like that. Because kind of had this list of different adverbs and objectives that you could select and to create a little description. And it was awesome. And then you came back with this one pager that kind of gave us basically role play vibes on who we were in the world. And it was awesome. It was one of the best like briefs I've received playing a game. And then it had like a second page that had some mechanical related stuff. But then this game's gone on. This was 2016. It's been run since then, which we'll talk about later. It's been obtained by people all over the world, but all these houses are now solidified in the lore, and people now play the game, and they play Draken, or they play Solterre or Colborn. And I really like that as a legacy of that original run. Very cool.
I like it too. When we initially ran it, we did consider the idea of doing almost a legacy thing where, you know, we would run another version that was, you know, 50 years or 500 years down the track, which I think would be an interesting idea. Ultimately, we decided to keep it like away from that just because of that thing of the barrier to entry. I definitely wanted to avoid the feeling of like, oh, this person feels like they have an advantage over me, or they have more over me because they know the history, because they were in the past mega game. Like, mega games are difficult enough to get into already.
Yeah. So I want to jump into some of the mechanics, not in too much detail, but just to run through them, because anyone who's listened to our episodes knows that I'm a big fan of the design. But first of all, I suppose before we go any deeper, we've talked about how the game doesn't have this really like rigid setting or anything like that, but it's clearly got some themes to it, and it's got a bit of background. What's the actual elevator pitch for this as a mega game? What are players getting into when they play God Emperor?
Sure. I think the elevator pitch we use on the rule book is it's a bloodstained fantasy mega game of power, lies, and regicide. When you join up, you join up in a house of up to five people who are a noble house, who are conspiring to try to gain power and gain the throne and get one over on the nine other noble houses that are all gathering as the God Emperor has become weak and is like fading, and his power is weakening, and now's the time when everyone gets a chance to strike and accomplish their goals. Yeah, and in order to do that, you and your team members will choose to go to the war map, where you can fight and battle stuff and gain castles, to the court, where you can pass laws and vote on permanent decrees that affect the rest of the game, or go to the underground, where you can scheme and commit espionage and poison people or assassinate people or do all that kind of sneaky stuff. And the twist to God Emperor is that, unlike Watch the Skies, where you have your general player who will always be going to the war map every round, everyone can go to every part of the game. You can choose each round whether it's more important this round that you have a lot of people on the war map, which means you'll be able to do more war stuff, or whether it's more important that you've got a critical law coming through the courts that you need to vote on, so you want to send people over to the court and have people there. And so the element of where you're sending people and where people are going and which section of the game do you want to focus on is a part of the strategy. And it's something you get to kind of vary up throughout the day, depending on what you're like enjoying and what part of the game you're excited about.
Yeah. And I remember that vividly happening, and I'm sure it's happened in subsequent runs where people would stack the deck. And I think the main memory I have of our team was that we stacked the court at one turn.
Mm.
One person went to the map and everyone else went to the court because we had to force something through.
Yep, absolutely. And that's a big exciting moment, which I'm really happy with, which is when like the five members of House Draken are all rocking up to the court at once and you're like, oh no, what are they planning?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I've often talked about God Emperor on this podcast as like some of the theatrics of it. And I remember that vividly. I remember that, and I also remember the coup, like when the military guys came in and took over. But
yeah,
I don't, when we stacked the council, I don't remember why. I just remember the act of doing it because it was so cool.
Like it had a
theatrical moment. I don't remember what
yeah, of course. I was definitely really inspired as well by interactive theater and things like that. I wanted to bring a little element of that into it, which is why that the God Emperor is an NPC who struts around and insults everyone and tries to be as evil as possible, and kind of dresses up a bit. Like having a little bit of theater in there, I think is really fun.
Yep. Yeah, it goes a long way. I remember it influenced the next design I had, which was the pirate game where we had a similar NPC. I know
that it was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a first in many ways for me, as like it was a first for players being a resource. It was a first for every game being so mechanically refined. It was a first for having an NPC. It was a lot of unique sort of design things.
Ideas.
So there's three different jurisdictions. I wanted to go into them, not in too much detail because we've probably talked about them before, but
each
one has a very clear flavor and inspiration. Did you want to run through them for us?
Yeah, certainly. So the map is very clearly inspired by Diplomacy, the classic board game. The way it works is that you write down what orders you're giving to your troops. Everyone writes these down simultaneously and secretly, and you can't show anyone, but you are allowed to talk to people and tell everyone what you're doing and lie to them, obviously. And at the same time that you're writing this down, you also tick a box that shows what houses you are allying with. And if you ally with a house, then you both... your troops can both be in the same space, they don't attack each other, and you can both combine to take out other threats. Just similar to Diplomacy, has the supporting thing there. So I guess the key dynamic there is, of course, you can talk to someone and say, hey, yes, let's ally together, let's be friends. And then you don't tick the ally box, and they've allied with you and you haven't, and you backstab them and take over and steal all their stuff. I tried to keep it as simple as possible, and while still having enough of that interesting kind of back and forth of alliances, I was excited to see. I think it is actually pretty viable to ally with people for quite a long time, which was exciting for me to see, which I didn't expect. Like, the in that run in 2016, we saw a lot of people, we saw houses that just were like, yeah, look, let's just be friends the whole game. And they just both shared the castle together. And yeah, it was great.
I think we did that, actually. I remember I never went to the map. We did have kind of designated players for certain areas because,
of course.
I mean, to be honest with myself, it was because some of us didn't understand some parts of the game.
Yeah, but,
I never went to the map, not out of choice, but just because I love the court. But I think memory, it seemed like all the, there was a lot of action at the end, but everyone was pretty timid earlier on at the map. But we, definitely, my team, Draken, we definitely had some teams that we stayed buddies with the entire time.
Yeah, that's great.
I didn't think about that as a, like how that would impact a game of diplomacy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And the game does have this mechanic where you can get married to a house, which is, it has a mild thing, which is that if you betray them on the war map, you're going to take a bit of a penalty. You exchange hostages, basically. But again, it was more, it was basically a bit of theater where you have a ceremony, you know, where you both get married together and everyone claps. That was really the important bit I discovered. Like, the mechanical stuff wasn't as important, but having a little ceremony where you're like, yeah, our houses are married together now. That's what really solidified the alliance, I think. And that's, I think in general, I found that, I mean, I think the mechanics are, I'm quite happy with the mechanics of God Emperor, but really, it's about the theater and the story moments, I think.
So speaking of the theater and the story moments, I think that was pretty heavily layered on at the court.
Yes.
Did you want to run through where the mechanics came from there?
Absolutely. So the court is quite simple. Each round, two of the noble houses get to propose laws. And it's on a rotating roster, basically, that goes through all the houses. And everyone else at the court gets to debate. Everyone who shows up to the court gets to cast one vote. So that's why you might want to send all five of your house team members if this is like an amazing, huge law that's going to have a big impact for you. The laws can do different mechanical things or thematic things. But the big element, which I think was it has been a big success, is having the God Emperor himself at the court. He breaks ties when there's a tie in the voting and is basically there to overact and insult everyone and be as evil as possible.
So, yeah, so in, I might, on that, because I found that really interesting, not just having an, like, the NPC was there to, I mean, in the documents that you provide with the game that you sell, which we'll talk more about, you mentioned the God Emperor as an NPC being kind of optional and that there's, you know, the player, that NPC doesn't necessarily have a mechanical impact on the game.
But sure.
At the same time, the non-mechanical impact is very role-playing and social, because in the rule book, for example, you say in the court section, the God Emperor is self-preserving, greedy, wicked, vain, and arbitrary, and in that order. And then you begin to say how, you know, the court game has this mechanical side to it, but at the same time, you should be trying to please the God Emperor and get the God Emperor to be on side with you so that you can support, you can get him to break ties for you. And an interesting thing that I was reminded of as I've been going through refreshing myself on things before we run the game is that the God Emperor, I believe, hopefully I don't get this wrong, decides if it, once a law is passed, the God Emperor decides who pays for it.
Yes, that's right.
So if you're really in the bad books for the God Emperor, you could have this taxation thrown on you that really over in the rest of the game, and then you can be forced to pay for its implementation.
Absolutely. So we really wanted people to hate the God Emperor, obviously. And in our run, it was Owen Sylvan was the God Emperor who did an incredible job. At some points, he was just openly asking for bribes. He's like, look, I'll make sure your law goes through if you bribe me, and just taking favor and power from people. Yeah. But everyone loved it, which was crazy that we were expecting the God Emperor to die very quickly. And I have been, I think it's been different in different runs, but I was surprised that in our run at least, that he survived a good long while. And then instead of actually being killed, he was peacefully deposed and was still alive, which was crazy to us. People just loved that interaction so much of like role playing out the oh God Emperor Sir, please look upon my family with honor, you know.
Which is pretty funny too, because it kind of fits the vague world that you've set, because it's all very dark and grim, and no one seems to be a hero. Like no one's really the protagonist. They're all kind of
definitely not
scheming little people who. No one's a good guy, so the fact that they get the tyrant down, then like you can hang around because we like you, is pretty fitting.
Absolutely, and we had some houses coming to him after he was deposed, going like, "Can we try to get you back on the throne?" Which was amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Best laid plans. So you've got the court, and when you talked to the Mega Game Assembly, you mentioned that was actually loosely inspired by Twilight Imperium, the political voting game.
Yeah, loosely. Basically when I first played, for anyone who hasn't played Twilight Imperium, it's a gigantic space board game that takes 8 hours to play. And it's a big space opera, and you have trade and politics, all this kind of stuff. And the political bit of the game is that you draw these agendas that everyone votes on. What inspired me really was, I guess, playing Twilight Imperium 3rd edition back in the day with some friends, where every time one of these agendas came out, we would kind of vote on it and have this big discussion in character. And then I guess we slowly realized that actually in Twilight Imperium 3rd edition, the agendas and the political stuff isn't actually that important a lot of the time. Like, it's actually, you know, you can kind of just go, oh, let's not bother, and just kind of, it's not actually that meaningful or a big deal. So I guess it was almost, in terms of inspiration, it was something I wanted to work against. Like, I wanted it to be really central and important.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I had the same experience. I played Twilight Imperium just last year for the first time in, like, probably 5 years. And I was the same when I got to the political, because you have to, for anyone who hasn't played it, you have to reach a certain milestone in the game before the political phase starts. And we were halfway through, which is like 4 hours or something. And the political phase started happening, and each turn we drew a card and read it. And we're like, let's just veto this out. No one really needs more complexity right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, and I guess the inspiration point was that in Twilight Imperium, it's random. The agendas come off the deck randomly. And I was like, you know, people should be proposing these laws. They should be like, hey, I want this law to go through. Because when it's random, you're like, well, I don't care if this goes through or not. Does anyone else care? And everyone's like, no, none of us care. Whereas if someone's proposing the law, and it's like, in God Emperor, it's like, two houses get to propose a law each round. So this is like your round. You get the spotlight for a bit. This is your chance to get your cool thing through. You know, it's a bit of at least someone cares about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was a thing I remember quite liking as well. There was a schedule, like a calendar for each turn of the game and where the court would be held, which was important because it was physically placed on the map. And there could be military coups, which did happen in the 2016 game, which was that awesome moment I always bring up.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's really good. It added a little bit of complexity, but I think it was worth it. It's basically like when it's your turn to propose the laws, that means the court is, you know, it's physically in that castle. And we show that on the war map by like putting it on there. And if I remember correctly, the God Emperor's immortal guard soldiers protect it. But if you can see, looking at the schedule, you're like, oh, the court is going to be here next turn, and prepare for it. And if you succeed in the military coup and overcome the God Emperor's guards, you can do take over it and just walk over, and you're like, I'm running the court now.
And it feels an extra layer of finickiness, you know, but it actually worked out really well because everyone throughout the game had a very fair opportunity to propose laws. Everyone had the same quantity of moments to do it. character knew from the start of the game when they were going to get that. So it informed strategy for the whole 12 turns that we played. When are we going to want to focus on the court? Because that's going to be our opportunity to put something major through that helps us. So that we need to plan ahead and know that we won't be able to be at the map as much or, you know, at the underground. So it actually added a lot to the game, that schedule.
Yeah, it does. It adds a bit of a tug that you can't, I mean, you could if you wanted to, but it adds a little bit of a push to say, hey, maybe you should shift people around a bit and not just send the same amount of people to every map every turn, you know.
And so the third part of the game is the one that I never touched because early in my mega game career, I barely touched board games yet. And I read the rules and I was like, I don't get it.
Yep, that's fair. Yes, the underground. So the underground, in terms of complexity, it's like the court is lowest complexity, the map is medium complexity, and the underground is higher complexity. The underground is inspired by Android Netrunner, the card game. Heavily simplified from that. Android Netrunner is very complicated. And I tried to... I would say the complexity of it does end up being a step above code names kind of thing. But I think when everything else is going on in a mega game, it can be a bit overwhelming for sure. I think the underground is one of those things where I was a bit concerned about the complexity, but in terms of the feedback we've got, the people who like the underground just love the underground and were like, this is the best. And in fact, when we've run future mega games and had spy things, we've, different spy games or espionage aspects to them. People have been like, just have the underground in there. Just put the same game in. So the way it works is that you have schemes, you fill out your scheme and write down what evil trick you want to do. Like you want to poison someone, you want to assassinate someone, things like that. You go to the table and you place that face down, and then you get a hand of cards, which are your minions. And the minions say rock, paper, or scissors on them. Basically, you can choose to do either. You place this. I'm doing a terrible job explaining this. What you do is you place those minions face down in front of your schemes in order to protect them. And then other players can use their minions to either protect their own schemes and make sure they go off, or use them to try to break through your minions to get to your scheme. So if you've placed down a rock face down, they can go and use their scissor minion to break it and to get through. When you place down your scheme, you do have to show which house it's pointing at, which house it's going to affect. Sometimes the schemes can be tricks or traps or ambushes, so it's just a bluff, right? Kind of the heart of it is that, yeah, it could be when you see a scheme pointed at you in the underground, it could be something like they're going to try to poison you, or it could be that they're trying to bait you into coming in and wasting your time trying to foil their scheme, and then it turns out it's just an ambush and you get beaten up. That's the basics of how it works. Each of the rock, paper, or scissors minions has their own effects. Basically, as you play, you can kind of figure out, like, oh, I think he's probably guarding this with a scissors card because it's got its own scissors have their own thing going on. That's basically how it works. And then the schemes that are more powerful take longer and more investment to pay off. So we had one scheme go off in the middle of in the 2016 game where people did manage to blow up someone's castle completely and just destroy it from the map, which was awesome. Lots of fun stuff like that happening.
Yeah. So it was sort of like and just to say face, I have to say now I fully understand the rules and I've read them. back in the day. It's really not that complex. And you've made both that and the council. I won't get too distracted, but both that and the council you made really clear by they've kind of got defined schemes and in the council defined laws that you can pick from to propose. You're allowed to create your own as well, but you've got pages and pages of examples.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so the Underground isn't too great. It is only about 4 pages of rules all up, but it can definitely be intimidating when in with a larger mega game, I think, is definitely a thing about. But with the pages of examples, we did... So basically, when we were doing playtesting, we got a lot of feedback where people were like, I'm not sure, like, what is a scheme? What can I do here, you know? Or what is a law? What can I do here? So we decided to have a lot of those examples. I think in retrospect, though, I would say sometimes it ended up feeling like those are... Because we had so many examples, I think some people ended up feeling like these are the only things I'm allowed to do. And that's definitely not the way that I intended it to be. It's intended to be, you know, like any mega game thing, that you can invent your own cool stuff to do. So I think in one of the things I was thinking about that I would do differently if I ran it today is instead of having the big page of all the examples, I would give each house like a small thing of 4 examples that fits their house and their style, right?
If you're a
particular vengeful house, then I would give you some laws and in your briefing and some example schemes that fit you. And with the disclaimer of like, hey, this doesn't have to be the whole thing. And it would also reduce the rule book by a couple of pages, which would be nice.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I remember you saying in previous conversations about it that what you were kind of trying to do with the Underground was take, like you said, take that thing that's in most mega games where there's some mechanism, like in Watch the Skies, for example, you have secret agents and they can do anything you want. But it usually ends up meaning you just give some money over or some, you know, currency of the game, and then you roll a die and see what happens and hope for the best.
I think that's kind of, it's not like it's like that in every mega game or anything, but in some ways it feels a bit like the default, is that, oh, I want to do something, I want to assassinate this person, I want to poison this person or do some spy thing. I will give in resources and then we'll have a die roll to see if it happens or not.
And that's present in most games, and it usually is quite simplified. Like I was just going to say, for The Crown, that's essentially what we did. We just... we did the dice rolls more privately, and it was more like, here's a guide to what kind of costs you're looking at, but you can do anything, and all you have to do is write down what you want, who it's targeting, put some money in the box, and then hope for the best, and you'll find out next turn what happened.
So definitely,
this is a much more mechanized, giving the players a bit more activity around doing these sabotage actions.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's nothing wrong with that style of doing things, the dice roll thing. And I've done that as well in my own designs. But I think what this achieves is that if something bad happens to you, like if you do get poisoned or your house gets blown up or something like that happens to you, it feels like you had fair warning and you had a really good chance to defend against it. Like, the scheme was pointed at you, and, like, maybe they bluffed you or whatever, you know. Maybe you were like, oh, I'm not sure if I want to deal with that. Maybe it's just a trap. But, like, you saw it happening, and it was going on, and it was there. There was an opportunity for you to tackle it and destroy it before it actually goes off and takes you down. And if you decide not to invest in the Underground, and you're not sending anyone there, and then your castle gets blown up, you're like, ah, well, they got us, you know. Which is really the feeling I wanted to have for sure. Because obviously with the Game of Thrones thing, like, it is intended that, you know, bad things can happen to you. But I always wanted it to feel like whenever anything bad happens to you, you have that feeling of like, ah, they got us, you know. They outfoxed us. They managed to, we should have seen that one coming. And not the feeling of like, oh, what? You know, like it just came out of nowhere. There was no way for us to get that one
before it happened. Well, that's something we talked about when we went, like, on our long rant about death in mega games. And it's really important, I think, that you have some explainer, like having people blindsided by things and making them feel like they don't have any control over what happened is generally a no-no. I think it came out very well. So that's the core mechanics. There's a few other bits and bobs in there, but they're the 3 main areas of interacting with the game. I wanted to talk a little bit, like, going back to 2016 and talk through the design process and how you came to creating this thing, because You were saying you ran Watch the Skies twice, I think, leading up to this, and then you went and signed this as third mega game. So do you remember, you know, how long did it take to do?
That's a good question. I don't know if I remember if it was at least a year, because we ran Watch the Skies the first time in 2014, then Watch the Skies 2 in 2015, and then God Emperor was 2016. Right. So it must have been about a year in total, something like that.
It was not you solo off the bat. You said that you started with a partner.
That's right. I had a lot of help playtesting, and we had a lot of really fantastic artists and graphic designers help out. Jason Yang and Gordy Higgins did a lot of the graphic design and the card design and things. Eric Valand was the graphic design on the rulebook, and Axel Torvenius did the big image of the God Emperor mask, which was awesome. That was fantastic. That was well worth it. It was a lot of playtesting with like local board game groups, or down at my local game store at the time had a playtest night where you could bring your designs and things like that. So bringing it down there. In order to test it, we split it up into basically party games, right? Like each section of the game tested it as if it was its own board game almost to see if it worked out and see if it worked. Testing a lot of like playing the game of the underground against different people playing the game of the war map against different people in that's the reason why the map of God Emperor is split into those three bowls almost of like you can notice it if you look at the map, but basically instead of one big map of nine houses all jumbled up together, it's kind of split into each, you know, three houses are all in a little place where they interact with each other at first and then can spread out to interact with the other houses after they've had a few rounds to spread out, if that makes sense. So in playtesting, we could test one of the bowls of three houses with just a couple of other people and the couple of other people are representing the whole house and make sure that worked. And then we just needed to do couple of playtests of the whole war map. And then we had one big playtest of, I think we had with just three houses and each house having three members, basically, and doing that for a few rounds to see how it worked when it's all brought together into one big mega game. It was basically the way we did it is just really splitting out and making each module work on its own and then bringing them all together.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask that, how you did that pulling together part. Did you, because there's like the joy of this game, I think maybe the war map is I don't think there's an exception. They all seem to interact. Like they all have definitely. An interact with each other in some way. So how were you able to do much testing of that?
Not too much, honestly. It was basically we had one big playtest of all of the stuff all together. Maybe a couple of other bits and pieces from what I can remember. But basically we were relying on it, in terms of the way it's designed, the court, it's pretty simple, I guess. It's just the court, you can pass laws that affect the underground or that affect the war map. On the underground, you can pass schemes that affect the war map or affect the court or affect anything, obviously. And in playtesting, we were kind of just playtesting it with blank schemes, right? Or like blank laws, ignoring kind of the ultimate overall effect. So I guess, the economy of the entire game when all, you know, 50 players are all together, that wasn't tested very much. We focused on I guess, the individual bits. I think it does definitely come together well. Like, it does feel very integrated, especially, yeah, the thing that, like, with the court traveling around the war map and stuff like that, and the fact that the war map can go over there. Like, yeah, it does. But it wasn't as much playtested, I guess.
No, okay. I mean, I guess a lot of the interactions are light touch, or they're simple. Like, for example, the schemes can impact the war map. Say you assassinate, like, you could destroy a unit or something on there. It's a different flavor to a similar action that could already happen on that in that domain, I suppose.
Yeah.
It seemed to work pretty smoothly in play. When you're talking about the broad design process, is there anything that you really learnt, like any fumbles throughout that process? Because this was your first main mega game design. Did you learn any major golden rules about the design process going through it and through the playtest?
Golden rules. That's a good question. I think, it taught me, I think first of all, the principle of just designing three board games and then sticking together with them together with duct tape, I think is good. That's a good way to do it. You can definitely do it that way and it works because it makes it so much easier to play test and to actually see how it works in practice without having, 23 people to play test. The downside is you can't use it if your game is completely holistic or completely, if you're trying to make a game that has a more emergent economy or that has less barriers between it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Things I learned. Simultaneous actions are so, so important for mega games. I learned that. We definitely had some test mechanics that weren't quite... It's like whenever anyone is making a decision, it needs to be that every single person is making that decision at the same time. And that's why, the war map has the mechanic of you all write your orders and then reveal them and carry them out at the same time. The underground works the same way, the court works the same way, you all vote at once. You can't do anything, like if everyone is taking a turn and nine players could be at the court table, I think it's a pretty obvious lesson, but that's definitely something I learned.
Yeah.
And it needs to be super simple. I think that's something I learned as well. I think, I don't know. I think I would not change the underground now because I think so many people love it. But definitely in future designs, I think we tried to stick it to basically, like a party game level of like a werewolf level of complexity. But I think definitely keeping the mechanics as simple as possible is really important, which is kind of crazy because, you're playing this game for 8 hours, maybe 6 hours, whatever, for a mega game. You kind of expect things to be pretty meaty, but the individual bits need to be very simple because there is so much else going on in the entire ecosystem of all those individual bits interacting together.
Yes. So lessons learned, you've done the playtesting, you've made the game. This was a long time ago. Do you think that you would ever go back and do it again, like remake God Emperor or refine it?
Version 2? I don't know if I would. There's things I would... if I was designing God Emperor from scratch now, there are things I would change. But I think looking at the mechanics, I just do feel still very fond of them, There are small things. There are a couple of small things I would change. One of them is, I'll just mention, each house has at the start of the game has something that they owe another house and they have something over another house. So it's like, for example, you've got a hostage from this house, but you have something over this other house where you have a hostage, you have their food or whatever, like stuff like that. Just to add a little bit of politics in the start of it. I think I made those things just line up a bit too neatly, though, because what happened in our run through. I mean, not that it's a terrible issue, but everyone was just like, oh, hold on, I'll give you the thing that I have from you, and then you give the thing that you have over to this person, and then they give the thing that they have over to me, and we just all swap it around, and we're all neutral, and we're done, and we just do that ASAP, and it's done. So I would make those a little more complicated and a little more thorny to encourage more roleplay there. I would, if I was remaking God Emperor from scratch today, or another game where, which has this worker placement people system, where the more people you send to a place, the more impactful it is, and you can swap around. If I was doing that again today, I would make it a universal resolution system where, like, every mini game has the same basic mechanic, like in D&D, where, you know, you're doing all this different stuff, but at the end of the day, you are rolling a d20 and adding your stat no matter what you're doing. Like, something like that to encourage people to swap around more, because I think that's definitely a key piece of feedback, is that people do get kind of intimidated, and they're like, well, I know what the court is like, or I know what the war map is like. I just want to sit here and check out the war map and feel comfortable with that. And I think having it be a bit more universal, where it's like, oh, if you know how the war map works, then you have a basic understanding of the mechanics of the other place. That might help encourage people to move around more. But at the same time, having said that, I definitely, you know, I don't think I would revise and take that out of the current edition. I think it adds a lot of depth to the game and a lot of replayability that you're like, wow, I can go to the underground and it feels totally different. It's like a different world, and I can, you know, if I play this three times, then now I'm the master and I can go between whatever map I want. Like, it does add a lot to the game in the current iteration, but I think that's what I'd do if I was making the same type of game again.
It's a bit of a tightrope to walk with that, because I kind of agree with you as far as accessibility and teaching it to people, that kind of thing. But at the same time, I think it would be a bit more, it wouldn't be as exciting if everywhere you went, it was just sort of a different theme, but you did the same thing.
Yeah. Like, no, you're right. It's true.
I mean,
it's tough.
Yeah. You'd have to balance that out. There'd need to be enough diversity, enough change to still spice it up a bit, because the thing that made it so interesting was how like internally, how confined each minigame was. They were so different to each other, and they clearly interacted, but their mechanics didn't overlap really. Like,
it's a different world. It's true. And it feels like it does. It's true. It does give you a very different feeling than the feeling of just going over and going, oh, here I'm still rolling a d20 and adding my stat. Mm-hmm. You're right. It's true. It's just a tough problem. I think, it's maybe a problem that could be solved by more educational tools and more tutorials and things like that as well.
Yeah. Well, that was one thing, actually, as far as sort of running the game went. From my memory, you did sort of, at the start of the game, you did that kind of tutorial round where people got a location and they got taught the game. And I was thinking that fell into the trap of having roles. So we sent people off to those areas and they stuck to it for the day because they learned it. So maybe like some, you know, it's hard to teach 50 people in a room all the same thing and it'd take like half an hour. But yeah, maybe just the way that you share the knowledge around at the start of the game.
It's true. It would have been good to do it would be good to do a rotation of people around, but you do run into the issue of, if I run through and explain each of these three games to every player, are they going to be just overwhelmed and forget everything anyway, you know, by the end of the explanation? It's tough because each game is individually very, very simple, I would say. Compared to a board game, if you sat down and played it as a board game, I think you'd pick it up pretty quickly. Even the Underground, it's only 4 pages, but yeah, it's I don't know. I think it's okay that God Emperor is a bit complex. I think overall, I would say it's not over complex. It is the level of complexity it needs to be to get this experience across. It's just maybe more tutorialization or better learning things could help there.
And so the game, once you ran it and you sort of wrapped it up and we're happy with the polish on it, you've put it out there in the world for people to 2015, that's how I got my hands on it. But you've had other people run it around the world, and also just to grab it, grab like hold of it from you. Do you know how many times it's been run?
I don't know exactly. It's been bought about 79 times, which is pretty cool. But in terms of the exact numbers, I don't know. I have been fairly hands off with it. It's just on Drive-Thru RPG, so you don't need to email me directly to get the rules or get official approval or anything like that. It's just it's something you can just do. But yeah, I know it's been run in the UK. It's been run at Gen Con. It was run in Texas. I think Austin Mega Games. It's been run a couple of places across Australia. So yeah, I mean, I'm definitely happy that it has been around the world a bit.
It's a bit of a notorious one, and you've received like positive feedback from people, or
yeah, absolutely.
Did anyone sort of come back to you and say, "Hey, this part of the game didn't work," or?
No, which is very nice. people have been very nice to me, which is great. I haven't had any negative feedback in general. I think people have been, I've been one of the worst critics. Yeah, people have been very positive about it. Some people have objected to the theme, the religious theme, and in Austin Mega Games, they changed the name. Instead of God Emperor, they changed it to Heavy Rain, which I think is a great pun. But I haven't had any key standouts of people saying, like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
Which is good. I haven't really had any serious negative feedback. Generally, people have said they're really happy with it in terms of, you know, readability, things like that, which has been really lovely.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, you know, like I was going to wrap this up. One thing I would just point out that I thought was quite good, and I wondered where the inspiration came from, or if it's sort of just a obvious thing to do in your head. But one thing I really like about the rule book is it gives some meta commentary. So the war map, at the end of the war map rules, there's a couple of paragraphs that say, be careful of this. And this thing here is literally a prisoner's dilemma. So you've got to be careful who you make deals with. Like, it really spells it out so that when you read it, you're like, oh shit, this game is going to be pretty ruthless. And you do the same with the underground and with the court. And you really, like with the court section I was mentioning before, you kind of spell out how to deal with the God Emperor. And what the meta is of that. So, like, you've got the mechanics there, but then after them you've said, so here's how you should interpret the mechanics and here's some strategy to use. In the war map, for example, you say, you know, here's the war map rules, here's how it works. And at the end of it, you're like, so how to play the war map. And it says, houses, talk to everyone, communicate ahead of time. There's nothing that stops you from lying through your teeth, but remember that other people are doing it. It talks about, yes, you can get extra points if you share a castle with another house, but being their ally when they don't ally with you is absolutely lethal. So you have to be careful of that. Like, you really, it's got a fine point, is, you know, for anyone who might have missed the nuance to the rules.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think it's always an interesting dilemma of how to handle that with rule books, which board games really struggle with, is how much should it be a reference text that is just telling you the rules, and how much should it be giving you guidelines for new players and telling you how to get into it? I definitely tried to a lot of the actual rules bits of the rule book are pretty to the point and pretty concise. I wanted to include, like, yeah, I wanted to give guidelines of, like, the one of the wonderful things about Mega Games is that you know, because they've got these different parts to them, that you can go to the part that you're more interested in, and you can have this area like the court that is more role playing focused, or the war map, which is more mechanically focused. And so, I mean, that's what a lot of it is based on. It's like, hey, you should go to the war map if you enjoy board games like Diplomacy or Game of Thrones. That's part of the advice. And then I guess the other part is like when you like there is a bit to this game, I guess. And when you go into a mega game, it's probably a lot of the time your first time playing that mega game. So yeah, I don't know. I wanted to make sure that people have a bit of an like a gentle strategic guiding when they go in.
It's almost like the teach starts in the book, kind of. It's like, here's the rules, and then how do you actually play them? So think about this and think about that. And
yeah, I'm very happy with the God Emperor is 1, self-preserving, 2, greedy, 3, wicked, 4, vain, 5, arbitrary, in that order. Yeah, I was inspired by there's a riddle about pirates that has that format. It's like if there are 10 pirates and they are number 1, they're greedy, but number 2, they're self-preserving, you know, in this order, then what will the pirates do in this situation, you know?
Mm-hmm. I love it. Okay, well, I will. We've talked for a while. I will let you go, but I just wanted to end, I suppose. Watch the Skies came first, ran it a couple of times, did your magic on it. Then you created God Emperor, and then We Are Not Alone came after that. And is that the last mega game that you have run?
It is so far, yes. We Are Not Alone was in... Well, unless you include... We Are Not Alone was in 2019. We did do some experimentation with online mega games throughout COVID, with Dark and Stormy Night. But it is the last official mega game that I have run, yes. Definitely have a lot of designs, which I'm hoping to get into now that we are somewhat out of the dark era, but absolutely.
Good. Okay. All right. Well, I won't pray into them now, but maybe another day we will have a conversation about all our hidden designs.
Another day.
Was there anything else you wanted to add? What are any other final things that anyone needs to know about God Emperor?
No, I will just say it is up on, if you search God Emperor and DriveThruRPG, you can get it. And I'll say for anyone who gets it, I'm very open to any changes anyone wants to make is totally fine by me. I think, my philosophy is that once you've got it and you're running it, it's your game, really. Like, you're the one who's putting the effort in to get it to the table with 50 other players. So anything you want to do is up to you. But I would love, if anyone is running it, please do shoot me an email and let me know how it went, because I would love to hear it.
Excellent. Yes, we would all love to hear about it. Thanks for your time, Jack, and thanks for jumping on the other side.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.